This is Ed Melnick, host of the Singer-Songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler, on the first Monday of every month between 2 and 4 p.m. I'd like to invite you to join me on December 1st for a very special Monday Sampler. In the second hour of the show, we'll be featuring Bob Dylan and the band, The Complete Basement Tapes. In this one-hour special, you'll hear many of the songs from the Basement Tapes, as well as insights from Dylan's biographer, Clinton Halen, producer Steve Berkowitz, and many others. Rita Houston narrates, tying the whole thing together. That's Monday, December 1st at 3 p.m. right here on the Monday Sampler.
Be a part of Giving Tuesday on December 2nd, a day that inspires personal philanthropy and encourages bigger, better, and smarter charitable giving during the holiday season. KBOO is excited to participate, and we have a $5,000 match for the month of December. All new memberships and additional donations made by current members will be matched. If you gave $60 last year and decide to give $100, it will be matched for the $40 increase. If you give monthly and give an additional one-time gift, that amount will be matched. Go to kboo.fm/give to make your donation now. And thank you to the Juan Young Trust, Vernier Software, SSI Shredding Systems, and the Wendy Foundation for empowering KBOO with their matching contributions. Thank you for your support.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this December 1st Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll talk immigration policy, police violence, Edward Snowden and Citizen Four, and Keynes versus Marx. We'll open the show with Old Mole Bill Resnick talking with Larry Kleinman. Kleinman is co-founder of the Oregon Farm Workers Union, PICUN, and is now working nationally on immigration rights struggles and preparing for changes in the law. They'll talk about Obama's recent controversial executive order as well as the future of immigrant politics in this country. This followed by Well-Read Red, Fran Michel, with an article by Robin Kelly, Why We Won't Wait, Resisting the War Against Black and Brown Underclass. In the second half of our program, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk The Left and the Law with a discussion of the new documentary film Citizen Four. Filmmaker Laura Poitras intimately documents whistleblower Edward Snowden's effort to expose the intrusive post-9/11 U.S. eavesdropping industry. And Tom Becker concludes our show this morning with a reading of Carl Finnemore's Counterpunch article, Move Over Keynes, Make Room for Marx, Radical Ideas for Radical Times. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we'll turn to Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman.
Larry Kleinman, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be with you.
Larry Kleinman's one of the founders of PICUN, Oregon's Farm Worker Union. Larry, why don't you talk about your work in PICUN for all those years and now how you're currently entertaining yourself.
Yeah, right. Well, I appreciate being on KBOO once again with you. And I'll just say quickly that PICUN has been around for almost three decades, but the movement that founded PICUN started in the late 70s around immigrant rights, defending people against immigration raids. A few of us started with kind of less than nothing and built out gradually community organization, labor union, workers' rights, housing, Now we have a radio station, a network of organizations designed to build community, but also build progressive movement.
And you trained your replacement, Larry. Now you're still on the board of PCCUN, I understand, and working on strategy and the direction of PCCUN. But you're now working also on a national stage?
Right. I stepped down a year ago as Secretary-Treasurer in a planned transition that was a generational shift. And my successor, Jaime Arredondo, whose family have been PCCUN members for almost 30 years, is doing a great job leading union programs, union strategy, electoral work. Did a great piece of work here in this last election, I thought. And it has also freed me up to do national work to prepare our movement, our organizations across the country as much as we reasonably can for immigration change, whether it's legislative or administrative. And, of course, we've just seen a big announcement by the president on an administrative program.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that later. You're playing really an important role now in the national immigrant rights and protection and advance struggle. Tell us about it.
Well, I've played a role off and on nationally for many years, together with PCCUN President Ramon Ramirez, who's played a more prominent role. So there are two levels on which I'm now playing a leadership role nationally. One is with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement, FIRM. You may see them quoted in the paper sometimes. That's a network of about two dozen immigrant rights organizations or coalitions around the country, grounded in the Center for Community Change. And the other is a new formation, a coalition of national organizations, about 20 of them, that's called the Committee for Immigration Reform Implementation. That was formed, I co-founded that about 18 months ago, with the notion that we must be ready for what may come, even if we don't know that it will come. And so its role is to align efforts and especially focus on the efforts that all of us will need wherever we are, but that it is not the best use of time and effort for all of us to be doing those things. And the example I use is, say, a PowerPoint now being shown in countless places around the country that explains on a basic level what the president has just announced. That's the kind of thing that could be separately prepared by 500 different people around the country who need it immediately because the community needs it. Or it could be done by a team of folks quickly, put out there generously, and adapted, used as is, or adapted by those 500 and plus folks who then can use the time that they would have spent on that on doing something local that nobody else could do but them.
Including communications. It's not that you're there's always this problem of doing things centrally and the people and the local people never develop their capacity. That's one of the things you want to do is to get people involved and do that capacity, help people develop themselves at the local level.
And, our credo is if you want to develop this yourself, go ahead, by all means. In many cases, these are things that local folks know how to do, but they don't, and they can spend the time to do it. But in that critical, what we call first response, when the community is hungry for accurate information, it not only does well by the community, but it builds the credibility of the organization to be able to deliver quickly.
Let's get back to the capacity of the immigrant rights organizations to actually act and the way that you're helping them. First, though, let's talk about the Obama's executive order. How did it come about, and what is it first?
Well, he announced 12 different changes, many of which are about enforcement or procedures within the Department of Homeland Security. But the one that's getting the big attention, and rightfully so, is an order on what's called deferred action. And this is an area of broad discretion that the president has to decide how to prioritize the enforcement of the law, of immigration law. And it's a program called DAPA, which is Deferred Action for Parental Accountability. And it's patterned very closely on the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that many of your listeners will be familiar with, that was announced in 2012. And this was the temporary work permits for the Dreamers, as they're commonly known. So this takes that same template and expands it quite a bit. The estimates are that between an ordered expansion of DACA and this new DAPA program, that there are somewhere between 4 and 5 million people potentially eligible.
And they're eligible, I gather, to get work permits and to be able to live in the United States without fear of being deported, at least until the next president either sort of affirms this policy by not acting or affirms it, in fact, explicitly, or the next president just does his or her executive order and returns to the current system, which is enormously draconian. People dispute how many people Obama has actually deported, but it's not less than Bush, and it's probably, and some figures show much greater. Tell us first about what Obama has been doing, and then we can talk about why he was forced to some extent, it seems to me, reverse the administration policy.
Absolutely. I think most of the, I wouldn't call it controversy, but most of the discussion about how many people he's deported glosses over the distinction, if it's important to people, about where people are apprehended. And people imagine when they talk about 2 million deportations that these are all happening in the interior of the country, but that's not so. 70% of those detentions are happening at the border. But nonetheless, the problem really for Obama has been that in the Bush years, there was a huge buildup of the Border Patrol and a huge set of appropriations and mandates with those appropriations, including quotas on how many people need to be detained on any given night around the country. And he was left with a machinery that he was hard-pressed to dismantle. Now, I'm one of the people that thinks that he could have done a lot more to dismantle it, but this was not an apparatus of his creation. It was an apparatus that he was handed as the incoming president. I think he expected that immigration reform would go forward promptly at a couple of different junctures. People fault him perhaps for not being stronger in his advocacy or his legislative maneuvering around that, but it didn't happen. And it didn't happen, I think, largely because he, and maybe to a larger extent, we all underestimated the hold that the anti-immigrant wing of the Republican Party would have on the rest of the Republican Party. And that has been played out, as your listeners are well aware, from years now, and it's still playing out today. So finally, we got to a point last summer where he basically said, I've had it. You guys have had a year to deal with the Senate bill in the House. You haven't done it. If you called it up, it would pass tomorrow. And that's true. From my sources tell me that's exactly right. There were the votes on the floor to pass the Senate bill, flawed as it was and still is. And he said, I'm going to act alone. He postponed that in September. That was a great disappointment to the community, but now he's followed through. And I think acted pretty close to the full amount that he could do, reasonably so, using his executive authority without it tipping over into sort of a blanket non-enforcement of the law, which would make the program more vulnerable.
And in fact, make him impeachable is my sense. And he may be.
Yeah, although I think that, I think the potentially, so that just to analyze the politics of this for a minute. So now he's creating a fact on the ground. This actually won't roll out for about 6 months because they've got to get the, machinery in place. And, the USCIS, the agency, Citizenship and Immigration Services, the agency that handles this, normally processes about 5 million applications a year with a staff of 13,000. And they're getting no money from Congress, needless to say. In fact, Congress is chomping at the bit to find any way to shut this program down, including potentially shutting down the government or forcing a confrontation of that nature. And one of the big challenges in the run-up to this is to figure out, well, how, never mind the politics, never mind the law, how are we going to actually stand this up, a program that suddenly opens the door to millions of people, just bureaucratically? How is that going to work, right? So they've given themselves 6 months. They're already well into the planning, needless to say, and they're confident they can do it, but they're going to need lead time to align the staffing, the facilities, et cetera, to do that. They're patterning it on an existing application process, which is DACA. That's good. Everybody knows how that works, including inside and outside the government. And then it'll unfold, as you say, until another president either modifies it or rescinds it, or until the Congress acts to confirm it, which is what I think will happen in the next presidency. One interesting difference that suggests that arc of events into the future is that while DACA offered permits that were 2 years, they have now changed that to be 3 years. So when folks start getting permits probably next summer, the soonest as a practical matter, and as DACA recipients are renewing, which they're now up for renewal, having gotten their permits about 2 years ago, they're now going to get 3-year permits. And that, of course, projects them a little further into the future. So we're talking 2018, 2019, as it rolls forward. That creates the space of a year or two in the next presidency and the next Congress, like the Congress after this coming Congress, to say, all right, now don't we need to finally deal with immigration legislatively? Because folks with DAPA or DACA are going to be left in limbo. They have no path to permanent residence because the president cannot open a path by executive order.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Larry Kleinman, who was one of the founders of Pikun, still with Pikun, but spending most of his time now at a national level helping local organizations gain capacity and struggle in what is a new chapter, or maybe subchapter, in the immigration struggle after Obama's recent executive order. We've been talking about the impact of the executive order. Larry, but one thing I think we have to though specify and be really clear about, this really affects about 4 million of the maybe 10 to 12 to 14 million, it's hard to know how many, undocumented workers are living in the United States. When you talk about immigration reform, those people now feel left out. How does that leave the movement in that, whatever it is, 30 or 40% of people, and mostly undocumented people with family here who are citizens, are impacted? The other people are not. Does that change anything?
Sure. That's, of course, a source of great disappointment and continued anguish, and rightly so. And I think that people understand, or are coming to understand, that this, they certainly understand this is not what we need, but they also, I think, understand that this is a step in that direction, just as DACA was. You know, DACA for Dreamers was estimated to have a million plus folks that were eligible. 700,000 have applied, more than 600,000 have been approved. There's continued discussion about what is the size of the undocumented population, and nobody really knows. The estimates everybody quotes from policy institutes is about 11 million. But nonetheless, everybody knows that there's at least half, and maybe well more than half, of the undocumented population who is not served by this. And so the struggle must continue, and that is the message. The struggle will continue to defend this program. The struggle will also continue to expand protection, but that's going to have to be legislative. It's not likely to be administrative. And that means going straight up the Republican Congress. I mean, they claim they want to do something about immigration. Well, it's put up or shut up time, because they're about to control the Congress fully. And Latino voters and Asian voters and many others will be watching them closely to see whether their actions match their rhetoric, or whether they will be consumed yet again by the radical anti-immigrant wing of their party, which is relatively small but very vocal and very influential, especially in presidential primary states early in the process, who will be pulling the party to the right and basically using any tactic that they possibly can, to including calling for impeachment, including shutting down the government, including embargoing all of Obama's appointees to any position, and so on. They'll be clamoring for those actions, and the more establishment Republican Party leaders are either going to have to embrace that or push back on it or just pull back. It's not clear exactly. I think they don't know right now what they're going to do, but they have a really big problem because their brand is utterly broken in the immigrant community.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Larry Kleinman, who's now working nationally in the immigrants' rights movement, one of the leaders. Larry, we were talking about the Republican Party and the splits in the Republican Party between the establishment wing, who, in fact, want to bring in more immigrants, partly and often, especially the farm sector of the corporate apparatus, the agricultural. They really need those cheap workers and cheap, reliable, controllable workers. They're pushing hard for immigration reform, as is Silicon Valley. They want to get cheap kids from India to work there and other places, mostly Asian, and they come fairly cheap and work very hard. It seems to me there really is a tremendous sort of elite consensus almost on bringing more immigrants in. But that elite consensus ends, or maybe there's a consensus on that too, on, in fact, working cheap and making sure that your labor is easily controllable. That's probably the entire elite believes that, and all of Congress. It seems to me that the struggle for immigrant rights has to include, and I'm sure that all the organizations understand that, has to include a focus on at least two other things that really impact immigrants. One is the structure of rewards in this economy and the distribution of income. Immigrants are really at the bottom, along with a lot of whites and blacks, actually. There's a very large sector, but they're all competing with one another for terrible, terrible jobs. And secondly, climate change is really impacting immigrants right now, especially in California, with over 2.5 million undocumented people, mostly from Latin America, but a lot of Asians, actually, and some Europeans even. It seems to me the immigrant rights movement has to be involved in all of those, in those questions. Tell us about the movement and its struggles beyond making sure that immigrants can work here.
Well, I think that's a great question, because what it really asks is, it goes to the heart of both what the vision is of this movement and what its capacity is. And I think this movement has a big vision. I think one of the most dynamic sources of new leadership of young leaders, people of color, women, LGBT, all together in one surge, because I think that's largely what it's been. And so there's great potential to make a big impact on American politics writ large for a long time. And so one of the reasons why I'm personally so invested in helping to play a role to catalyze this opportunity is to build organization, to build capacity, to take the long view in doing so, to figure out how to resource it and make it sustainable. Because one of the phenomena we'll see going forward is this, as undocumented immigrants and their families, which include mixed status families in most cases, one member of the family is a citizen, the other member of the family is a lawful permanent resident, several members of the family are undocumented. Once those families start to feel like maybe they'll be able to stay and have some modicum of security, then people start looking around and saying, you know, I really do want to do something about the issues that affect me, the other issues that affect me, like my wages, like worker safety, like education opportunities, like climate change. But when I'm consumed by the insecurity of not knowing whether I'll be here tomorrow, it's really hard to muster the will and the capacity to engage in a consistent way in some of those other issues. And that's true of the organizations as well. But what a history has shown us is that communities in deep struggle do not remain in a progressive struggle, don't necessarily remain progressive left to their own devices. Because we live in capitalism, and capitalism deeply and endlessly emphasizes individualism. And so once people get a modicum of status, then that individualism starts to kick in and will continue to kick in. So our job and our challenge as the builders of progressive organization is to relentlessly engage those forces in a very practical way, so that Latinos and Asians who are becoming a bigger demographic force and electoral force in this country, and whose ranks in the voting realm and in civic engagement will become bigger and bigger, are a progressive force, and are a progressive force for a long time, not on one issue, not for a particular period. So that, to me, is the vision about how immigration connects with climate change and with worker rights and wages, for two examples. We want to see a vibrant force of immigrants rooted in Latino and Asian communities that has a broad progressive vision and holds to that vision long term. And this is an opportunity, an unusually promising opportunity, I would say, to help cement that as best we can and then continue moving that forward. And so it really, in the end, is about vision and capacity, not about whether people care about this or know about it, or have whether or not their politics are good or bad about it.
Larry Kleinman, keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill.
And talk to you again soon. Thanks.
Vivir cada día como si fuese el primero, y si es mi último día, aún así sería el primero. Ser feliz para mí es este momento, abrir mi ventana, sentir el viento, perder el aliento. Vivir a pulso, sentir el curso de las cosas según el impulso, su verdadero transcurso. Natural, mecerme, comerme la vida, llegar hasta el cuesco, empezar de nuevo mi partida. Vivir cada día como si fuese el predilecto, el color de las cosas tiene diferente aspecto. Cuando abrazas tu gente, el amor el mejor nutriente, el alimento que se ve el compuesto diferente. Sentarse en el parque y comer chocolate, sentir que por dentro hay un corazón fuerte que late. Para mí, ser feliz es esto, estar conversando contigo en medio del universo, tirarnos en el pasto, imaginar.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. You just heard a song from Ana Tijo, Humanidad. And we also heard from Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman talking about struggles around immigration and the recent executive order, Obama's recent executive controversial order. Later in the program, we'll hear from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, Left and the Law. They'll be discussing the film Citizen Four, which explores the Edward Snowden exposure of eavesdropping, the eavesdropping industry, in fact. But next, we'll hear from Fran Michelle, Well Read Red. She will have an article by Robin Kelly, Why We Won't Wait, Resisting the War Against Black and Brown Underclass.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle, here with a selection from an essay by Robin Kelly, published last week in Counterpunch. It's titled, Resisting the War Against the Black and Brown Underclass, and the whole thing is worth your attention. Here's just a portion of it. The immediate and sustained resistance to the police following Mike Brown's murder revealed the low-intensity war between the state and black people, and the disproportionate use of force against protesters following the grand jury's decision escalated the conflict. To the world at large, Ferguson looked like a war zone because the police resembled the military with their helmets, flak jackets, armed personnel carriers, and M16 rifles. But African-American residents of Ferguson and St. Louis proper and in impoverished communities across the country did not have to endure tear gas or face down riot cops to know that they were already living in a war zone. Whether we call it a war on drugs or Operation Ghetto Storm, as the Malcolm X grassroots movement dubs it, what we are dealing with is nothing less than permanent war waged by the state and its privatized allies on a mostly poor and marginalized black and brown working class. 5 centuries in the making, it stretches from slavery and imperialism to massive systemic criminalization. We see the effects on our children in the laws that make it easier to prosecute juveniles as adults, in the deluge of zero-tolerance policies, again a byproduct of the war on drugs, in the startling fact that expulsions and suspensions have risen exponentially despite a significant decline in violent crime. Crisis, moral panics, neoliberal policies, racism, fuel an expansive system of human management based on incarceration, surveillance, containment, pacification, lethal occupation, and gross misrepresentation. The black community of Ferguson and adjacent communities experience war every single day, in routine police stops, fines for noise ordinance violations, for fare hopping on St. Louis's light rail system, for uncut grass or unkempt property, trespassing, wearing saggy pants, expired driver's license or registration, disturbing the peace, among other things. If these fines or tickets are not paid, they may lead to jail time, the loss of one's car or other property, or the loss of one's children to social services. The criminal justice system is used to exact punishment and tribute, a kind of racial tax on poor and working-class black people. In 2013, Ferguson's municipal court issued nearly 33,000 arrest warrants to a population of just over 21,000, generating about $2.6 million in income for the municipality. That same year, 92% of searches and 86% of traffic stops in Ferguson involved black people. This despite the fact that 1 in 3 whites was found carrying illegal weapons or drugs, while only 1 in 5 blacks had contraband. If the police are charged with keeping the peace and protecting citizens, but instead have contributed to the epidemic of violent deaths, then a case can be made for the complete withdrawal of the police from black and brown neighborhoods. The police are trained for combat and often regard the youth in low-income communities of color as potential enemy combatants. In war, it's kill or be killed. In light of Missouri's failure to indict Darren Wilson for the murder of Mike Brown, calling for the withdrawal of the police, even temporarily, is a reasonable demand for people terrorized by state violence and feeling particularly vulnerable over their safety. They want law and order, but the police have shown a consistent disrespect for the law, flagrantly violated the Constitution, and operated with little or no accountability. Instead, the police operate as a rogue outfit. Their actions create disorder and fear, Furthermore, failure to indict effectively exonerates the police force, providing a pretext for the police to ramp up violence and repression in response to the legitimate expression of anger and frustration over the government's failure to protect black lives and ensure justice. It is already happening in the aftermath of the grand jury's decision as riot police invade the headquarters of Hands Up United, as well as designated safe spaces. The young organizers in Ferguson from Hands Up United, Lost Voices, Organization for Black Struggle, Don't Shoot Coalition, Millennial Activists United, and the like, understand that they are at war. Young black activists in the St. Louis area have not been waiting around for an indictment, nor are they waiting for the much-vaunted federal probe, for they have no illusions about a federal government that provides military hardware to local police, builds prisons, kills tens of thousands by manned and unmanned planes without due process, and arms Israel in its illegal wars and occupation. They have been organizing. So have the young Chicago activists who founded We Charge Genocide and the Black Youth Project, and the Los Angeles-based youth who make up the Community Rights Campaign, and the hundreds of organizations across the country challenging everyday state violence and occupation. They remind us not only that black lives matter, that should be self-evident, but that resistance matters. It matters because we are still grappling with the consequences of settler colonialism, racial capitalism, and patriarchy. It mattered in post-Katrina New Orleans, a key battleground in neoliberalism's unrelenting war on working people, where black organizers led multiracial coalitions to resist the privatization of schools, hospitals, public transit, public housing, and dismantling public sector unions. The young people of Ferguson continue to struggle with ferocity, not just to get justice for Mike Brown or to end police misconduct, but to dismantle racism once and for all, to bring down the empire, to ultimately end war. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel reading from Robin Kelly in Counterpunch.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7, listener-supported community radio. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. I'm here with Joe Clement, who is our engineer. You just heard Fran Michel with an article by Robin Kelly, Why We Won't Wait, Resisting the War Against Black and Brown Underclass. Later in our program, Tom Becker will conclude with a reading of Carl Finnemore's Counterpunch article, Move Over Keynes, Make Room for Marx, Radical Ideas for Radical Times. But next, we'll turn to The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. They review the film Citizen Four. Jan?
In her latest documentary, Citizen Four, director Laura Poitras completes her trilogy on post-9/11 America, begun with My Country, My Country in 2006 and The Oath in 2010. Poitras' subject is former NSA intelligence analyst Edward Snowden, the whistleblower who first made contact with Poitras under the codename Citizen Four. After opening scenes with the director narrating the backstory of how they met, we see Snowden holed up in a hotel room in Hong Kong in 2013 with Poitras, journalist Glenn Greenwald, and UK intelligence reporter Ewan McCaskill. Snowden, charged with violating the Espionage Act describes his political motivations for turning over large files of NSA secret information to Greenwald for publication in The Guardian. After a series of tense discussions over the likely fallout of his revelations on the massive scope of government spying, Snowden is spirited away to the UN embassy in Hong Kong and then to Moscow, where we see him briefly with his partner, Lindsay Mills, who has joined him in exile. Mike, well, after perhaps a near universal enthusiastic response to the documentary, there are a few critics who complain that Citizen 4 conforms too narrowly to a conventional heroic narrative line, that it's overly idealizing and too much of a thriller, and in a way, Snowden's own concern that his story would dominate the news is too fully realized in the documentary. What are your thoughts about this, and perhaps how we think about, critically, about heroic stories?
I think that's all nonsense. I think the movie, if anything, downplayed Snowden's heroism. It could have, for example, had as a thrilling climax his escape from Hong Kong, with all the forces of the world and the U.S. hell-bent on catching him and grabbing him. But it didn't. It deliberately diffused this thrilling center section with a more diffuse ending. And what the movie, I think, was really a thrilling movie, but an unusual one, in that we know what's going to happen ahead of time, but the characters don't. You know, the movie begins with Snowden, Greenwald, and Poitras in a cramped hotel room in Hong Kong, and they're about to release all the stuff, this fact that they've got stuff to release, and they don't know which way it's going to go. They don't know if the door is going to be kicked down at any moment. And the camera lingers on Snowden. You see him a lot. He becomes really well defined. And I think after a year and a half, because let's remember, Snowden did not surface in any way other than one 12-minute interview of him filmed by Poitras for well over a year, while all this information was allowed to surface, its impact was discussed. You know, Snowden loomed large in the background, but the focus was on the consequences of what turns out to be a non-existent privacy in the United States, for example, the invasion into corporations and governments of every country in the world. There are repercussions in every direction, and they were allowed to play out, to where at least my curiosity, and I think many other people on this planet, about the guy that started all the stuff that has happened, what's he like? Well, we know now. You know, he's kind of skinny, hyper-intelligent, very dedicated. He's like a deer in a forest, you know, alert for predators all around, sort of geekish.
There was something very, very endearing that came through, and a genuineness, a very contained quality. And I don't know, I didn't have the feeling I knew him, but that was any more than you can just look at a person. I mean, the camera does linger affectionately on him, you know, trying to fix his hair as he leaves. But there was, you know, there was some discussion of his family and not saying much about him. That last scene in Moscow, you see him and his girlfriend, Lindsay Mills, through a window, which I think is itself suggestive of a barrier that, you know, you don't know these people. So it, clearly the film was trying to walk this line of around bringing in his humanity without that being kind of the dominating theme. But, you know, I think one general critique that feminists have of the hero's journey, which is a narrative device used in countless ways in films, is the way in which a hero is often framed as someone of unusual autonomy, who kind of rises above the masses without the aid of others, intervenes in history. And here, I mean, you did... There might have been more on the support he got from others, but I think it was worth noting that it was a woman director who was herself taking political risks, who brought herself in the story. And I think it wasn't just of import because of the device of bringing her in the conversation, because she had been she was a political actor herself, but as a woman who took considerable risks, and we didn't see her, but we heard her voice, and she was very much a subject in the film, that he did depend on allies, and also to proceed and to find, to be spirited away to safety.
I think that clearly emerged from the film. You know, there was a lengthy portrait of Laura Poitras in The New Yorker 2 weeks ago. You know, she will emerge, but what she did was focus on the people who developed this intelligence, which proved decisively that the people in charge of gathering intelligence lie under oath. And why they would do it in an area when everybody wants to be safe from terrorism is another question. It has to do, I think, with the fact that not only were they gathering this information for terrorism purposes, but they were doing it for industrial and commercial purposes as well.
And that was only briefly noted in the course of the film, and indeed that was, I think, one of my only real concern with the film was that it I think did support more of a libertarian right leaning paranoia about the government, of which there is plenty of evidence to support that line of thought, but government spying also has to do with supporting industry, and I think it might be worth talking a bit about the difference between a left, what we might see as a more progressive, critical approach that looks at the economic system as a whole versus paranoia about the government and an anti-government right-wing position. The film, to me, was very much, it did not deal with, in any substantive way, about the economic interest behind spying.
Well, it had the most articulate presentation of that I've seen in any medium. When Glenn Greenwald addressed the Congress in Brazil, he described precisely that as the real motive for what's happening.
Now, it didn't go very far. It was much more to expose that was the pretense of spying. But I didn't think it went very far.
Well, what the movie did underline and what Snowden himself means is, what is the notion of privacy worth? Is privacy important to us? I mean, in the movie Minority Report, the Tom Cruise character walks into a department store and the store says, "Hi, Tom." I mean, we were approaching that sort of knowledge of us when we go on the internet. The internet knows our sex, our race, our age. It knows everything about us. It targets ads to us and is constantly developing new ways of getting even more intimate ads aimed at us. So aside from the fact that the government knows everything about you, you know, so what? Most people say, "I haven't done anything wrong." But what is the effect of knowing that you're constantly being monitored have on your thoughts, let alone on your actions?
Yeah, in a
these are critical questions.
Yeah, and quite interesting piece recently in the Monthly Review by David Price. He says, Americans now increasingly accept invasive electronic monitoring of their personal lives. Ideologies of surveillance are internalized as shifts in consciousness embedded within political economic formations converge with corporate and state surveillance desires. And that I think the shock of these revelations is, and the horror that I think anyone watches this film, it's like revisiting Return of the Repressed. You know, it's like, oh my God, the extent of it is just staggering. But is that shock itself a kind of displaced reaction to this more ordinary form of prevalence that where corporate capitalism, and with its global reach into every corner and crevice of our daily lives, is something that is increasingly accepted? And is the focus only on government spying of potential terrorists and the pretense of that a way of avoiding this other, more mundane, everyday problem?
Well, That's
obviously, I think yes, but
yeah, that's a whole movie by itself. But I think that
yet
is,
to be made.
That explains why they lied. Why James Clapper said that we weren't doing this. I think were the focus on avoiding terrorist attacks, why would he lie? We're taking these extreme measures in order to prevent the kind of tragedies that befell us on September 11th. That's going to prevail. But if he were to say, in order to keep Google a legitimate player in the world and not have it be discredited, in order for various corporations selling various things to know what their rivals in other countries are up to, we need to know this stuff, people would be really upset. So that's why they lie. They want to keep the fact that there is a huge component of this that having to do with industry and commerce. That is, and you see all the Silicon Valley companies backpedaling rapidly because this could, they pretend to be neutral. Like when you do a Google search, in theory, it's not going to bias you in any particular direction. Well, if they're biased in American directions, that's going to cost them a significant chunk of their business. So they wanted to keep that sort of spying and their interrelationships with the government agencies as secret as possible.
Yeah, and Applebaum, a cyber activist in the film, does reframe the issue of privacy as one of liberty, but he's still very much focusing on political thought, political speech, and the repressive effects of surveillance on what people can even think about. But there is this more subtly pervasive side of the commodification of everything, and how the two are hand in hand.
We can only hope there'll be another wave like there was in the early 70s. And periodically, there are great concern everywhere about intrusion by the government and by corporations. There's been two or three over Americans' history. Right now, it doesn't seem to be too close. But with a Republican president, for example, I think the opposition would develop in a stronger way. And there are possibilities, I think, for opposing this kind of collection of every one of our traits in some sort of centralized pool run by people who we have no reason to trust.
The military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower so famously described it. Just in closing, I would recommend our listeners check out the David Price article in Monthly Review on surveillance and global capitalism.
And see the movie, too.
And the movie is very much worth seeing. And clearly an important tribute to Edward Snowden. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the documentary Citizen 4.
Plan failed.
That's Adam and the Ants. Nine Plan Failed. We just heard from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, Left in the Law, on the documentary Citizen 4, Edward Snowden's efforts to expose the intrusive post-9/11 U.S. eavesdropping industry. We'll conclude our show this morning with Tom Becker. He has an article from Carl Finnemore's Counterpunch posting, Move Over Keynes, Make Room for Marx. Tom?
Good morning. John Maynard Keynes was the great reformist economist who, perhaps unwittingly, saved capitalism from self-destruction. Karl Marx was the great revolutionary economist who argued that capitalism was beyond reform. Today I'm going to share with you an article which argues that Keynesian reform has failed and that the overthrow of capitalism and private property is the only solution to the world's rapidly escalating problems, from grotesque income inequality to unchecked climate change. The article is entitled Radical Ideas for Radical Times, Move Over Keynes, Make Room for Marx, by Carl Fenimore. Capitalism is again in the crosshairs of global climate activists. To save the earth, declare young activists, we need earth-shaking change going beyond the narrow constraints of a system that unapologetically prioritizes profits over people. The clock is ticking, with scientists warning that substantial changes must be made in this century, or our environment will suffer irreparable damage. As a result, more and more people are becoming less and less patient with an unresponsive power structure saturated with dollars. For example, popular author and social activist Naomi Klein doesn't mince words in her most recent bestseller that unabashedly identifies the problem up front in her title, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Such a frank discussion of how private ownership of our natural resources poisons the earth below and pollutes the atmosphere above needs to shift to economics as well. In this realm, one of the most renowned figures of modern economics, John Maynard Keynes, described best the pitfalls of our privately owned economy by colorfully putting it this way, quote, "Capitalism is the astounding belief that the most wickedest of men will do the most wickedest of things for the greatest good of everyone," end quote. To get out from under this wickedness, I argue that we need to go beyond Keynesian reforms that normally propose massive government stimulus, creating more jobs. Of course, any and all reforms that offer even temporary relief should be fully supported. But Keynesian promotion of massive government spending does not address the biggest problem of our times, and something that Karl Marx was most concerned. Private ownership of production and surpluses created by the total workforce, and the ultimate control by capitalists over how and to whom the subsequent profits are distributed. In Marxist lingo, this imbalanced equation is the contradiction between private ownership by the few versus social production by the millions. Putting aside theory, Keynesian proposals also in practice put us on the defensive, continually asking relief from a government that represents big business and banks more than the average person. More fundamental reforms, Marxists advocate, would divert the nation's wealth toward working people and social needs even as it's produced, before the rich appropriate it for themselves. It can be done. To help explain the limitations and fragility of even the most ambitious reforms in our country that did not extend into reducing capitalist control of the social product, let's examine three historic legislative acts of the 1930s. It's hard to find other laws that have so significantly influenced our economic lives, yet two utterly failed to achieve their promise, and one is continually being undermined. They were the Wagner Act, legalizing the right to organize unions, the Fair Labor Standards Act, establishing the 40-hour work week, and an enormously significant Social Security Act. Each of these three monumental reforms of the Great Depression were, over time, corrupted and devalued as the power structure tweaked and twisted their original purpose. Today, the Wagner Act has been amended several times by Congress to distort and delay union representation by imposing on grievance settlements and contract negotiations an impossibly complex and paralyzing legal maze. At the same time, courts have obstructed organizing by giving employers too much leeway to threaten employees. The 40-hour work week is also a mockery of itself. Left unchanged for over 75 years, it is still drudgery to work a full week, yet it does not even necessarily guarantee a living wage, as we know from millions of fast food and Walmart workers. Worse yet for part-time and underemployed, it simply is not rationally necessary. As Eric Roch from MIT noted in his heralded 2000 paper, Productivity and the Work Week, quote, "An average worker needs to work a mere 11 hours per week to produce as much as one working 40 hours in 1950, end quote. This data is 14 years old. Productivity has increased even more since. Anticipating these productivity gains in 1930, Keynes himself predicted technological advancements would mean everyone eventually working just 15 hours a week. But alas, this did not happen, nor could it happen. Under capitalism, Keynes knew better than most, outcomes are not decided by logic, but by profit. Therefore, into whose pockets did proceeds from higher productivity go, if not to working people? That's a rhetorical question. And when it comes to the third great benefit of the 1930s, Social Security, there are continual threats to end guaranteed monthly payments by outsourcing retirement funds to the stock market, threats to stop annual inflation adjustments, and threats to increase the age of eligibility. These three most profound legislative acts are, therefore, prime examples of why changes are insufficient and subject to erosion as long as they do not establish social and economic standards, actually overruling the natural tendency of capitalists individually and through the government and courts to emphasize personal profits over people's needs. We expect no less from the super rich, so we must restrict their ability to selfishly decide how to distribute the benefits and values of production that are, after all, created collectively by working people. Each of us must rethink our loyalty to a system controlled by the few uber-rich families who currently dominate everything, who so dramatically limit our choices, and who make us consider impractical and utopian legitimate reforms designed to reshape and redesign our economy, and in fact, our whole world, to make it work better for us. Until the majority decides on the big picture of eliminating private ownership and control of our planet, and to put Marx's socialist vision of a new world community back on the table, it's a start. That was by Carl Finnemore, a delegate to the San Francisco Labor Council, AFL-CIO. This article, Radical Ideas for Radical Times, Move Over Keynes, Make Room for Marx, can be found on the Counterpunch webpage.
You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Coming up next on KBOO Radio, at 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Between the Lines with stories of how pro-choice activists are bracing for renewed efforts to further erode access to abortion and how immigrant rights activists are agitating for comprehensive immigration reform. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guests are Bob Jenks and Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary, working for affordable utility services, low-income consumer protection, energy efficiency, environmental stewardship, and renewable resources. At 11 o'clock, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. Today's guest is thyroid expert Dr. Isabella Wintz. We'll hear about Hashimoto's thyroiditis, finding and treating the root cause. And at 11:30, we'll hear Madness Radio with host Will Hall. Today's guest is Paula Kaplan, author of When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. Again, this has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. We are moles in the ground, tending to the global political challenges that face our communities. Thanks to our contributors and guest this morning. We had Bill Resnick, Larry Kleinman, Fran Michelle, Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker, Tom Becker, and myself, Denise Morris, your host, and Joe Clement, our engineer. Thanks for joining us this morning. We'll be back again next week.
are tuned KBOO Portland, and do stay tuned for Between the Lines, and that'll be coming up right after these messages.
KBOO's mini December drive is right around the corner. It will start on Thursday, December 4th and end on Saturday, December 6th. We are looking to raise $20,000 over these 3 days. We're also happy to announce that we have secured a $5,000 match thanks to the generosity of the Juan Young Trust, Vernier Software, SSI Shredding Systems, and the Wendy Foundation. This means if you've never given to KBOO, your donation will be doubled. If you give to us monthly and you give an additional one-time gift, that donation will be matched. If you give more to us this year than last year, then the difference will be matched. You can donate early by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you for supporting your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
On December 1st at 6:30 p.m., tune in to Prison Pipeline. We'll be discussing decriminalizing homelessness with Portland area activists Monica Beamer and Ibrahim Mubarak. They're members of the Western Regional Advocacy Project and are involved with a homeless Bill of Rights campaign, which would protect the rights of all persons to rest. We discuss how people with prior records are vulnerable to becoming houseless, and the history of vulnerable populations being criminalized, as well as how our society could save money by protecting, rather than criminalizing, people who do not have a safe place to sleep.